time to welcome Mecca to our sanctuary. And we are 1,000% behind Mecca. Absolutely. And we hope that this is the second in a long list of times that we will have and host Mecca here in the future. So may God bless us all as we enjoy this evening and as we learn. God bless you.
Thank you, Jack. And that was a little different than you usually hear at a Mecca event. But we are so lucky to be in this church and to have Jack supporting us. And I think that all of us here need to be supporting Jack, because there are a lot of people who have been very critical of his allowing Mecca to use this church. So I really hope that I'm not encouraging you to pray, but I hope that you are friends with Jack and support him and let him know how important it is to stand up the way he has, even though he's taken a lot of criticism for it. I want to welcome everybody who's here. I'm really happy to see so many people. And I'm Barbara Lubin, and I'm the director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Thank you. And this has been a really exciting month for us, this past month. Who would have thunk it? You know, here it was, this little art exhibit from Gaza, that when Sophia came to me and said that she wanted to bring it to Berkeley, I said, oh, I don't feel like it. We already did art exhibits, but we don't need it. And she kept pushing me and said, no, 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 we have to do it. I'll do all the work. Don't worry about it. And I said, oh, okay. And, you know, I thought, you know, it would go up at the Children's Museum and maybe 100 people might come to see it. But thanks to the Museum of Children's Art in Oakland, everybody around the world knows about the exhibit and has written to us from Turkey, from Denmark, from all over the world, and everybody's asking to have the exhibit come to their country. I'm very proud of the children in Gaza who drew these beautiful drawings, and I'm very happy for all of the support that all of you gave to us. And it's a big battle, and those people that pressured the museum are still out there. They're alive and well, and they will be pressuring anybody who tries to bring the words of the Palestinian people to the communities anywhere in the world. This is their job. Their job is to shut down the voices of Palestine. And it is our job to stand up to them and to bring these voices, to bring the drawings of the children, and to support the rights for justice for all of Palestinians. I want to, that's all right. This is a great evening ahead of us. I want to thank all of the people from Mecca, the whole staff, Ziad Abbas, Lena Al-Aryan, Penny Rosenwasser, Dahlia, Marina, God, everybody's name, Deborah Ager, Josie Shields-Stromsness, or is it Stromsness-Shields? I always get it mixed up. I want to thank everybody who works at Mecca, and I want to thank the other folks from our for-profit business, Alliance Graphics, especially Josh Sanchez, our wonderful artist. And he's the person that made a copy, did this whole copy of the exhibit, which is somewhere around in this place, and you can see it. And it was Josh who We signed, Sophia and I found the gallery at 917 Washington Street and signed the lease at 10 o'clock on Friday morning. And Joss came down there with us, and he hung the exhibit. He made these huge, gigantic pictures of the exhibit, and he made a copy of the exhibit so everybody could hold a copy of a drawing and march with it the next morning. And none of that would have happened without Joss. And I'm so lucky. He's my friend and has worked with Mecca for the last 20-some years. Who else do I want to thank? Lots of people. I did thank Jack, the Reverend, but also his staff, Dee and Gus, who have helped us tonight. And I want to thank Link TV, the best TV station in the world. They're here filming this tonight, and they will get the word out. People will hear Allison and Ali all over the place. Very important to support Link TV. And now a few quick announcements, and then I'll get out of here. I already talked about the exhibit. We're trying to figure out the hours. We're going to have volunteers there, but it will be hanging for 2 months. And I hope that you'll come see it. I hope you'll bring your church groups. I hope you'll bring kids there, your children, classrooms. We want everybody to see it and talk about it. And let's see. The Anahora Tour, which is a play about, I have it written on three places here. It's a play by Palestinian from Haifa, and it's about torture and interrogation of Palestinian activists. Clearly, almost every man, boy, old man, young man in Palestine has at one time or another been in an Israeli prison and has been tortured, and also women. And at this very moment, there are over 300 children under the age of 14 who are in Israeli prisons being tortured. And this is going to be at La Peña Sunday, October 9th at 7 o'clock. And I understand it's going to be playing, I think, for several days, but I don't know where else. So I think there are cards out in the lobby and you can grab them. It's supposed to be a fabulous play. The Arab Film Festival starts next Thursday, October 13th, for 10 days. Postcards in the lobby. And also Tariq Ali, who is a joy to listen to, who wrote a great book about the 60s, 1960s. Most of us here tonight remember them. And he's going to be speaking where? His speech is called The Arab World, People's Power and the Future of Palestine, on Saturday, October 29th at 6 p.m. at the First Congregational Church of Oakland, right a few blocks from here. And that's presented by Al Alda and Mecca, and there's more information in the lobbies. I want to know, does everybody who's here tonight, have you all heard about Mecca? Do you know about us? Is there anybody who doesn't? Is there anybody who doesn't know about our work? Stand up and show yourselves. No, just kidding. For the last 23 years, Mecca has been working in Palestine, sometimes in the camps in Lebanon, and in Iraq, all during the sanctions. We've built playgrounds. We've delivered millions of dollars of food and medicine to children in refugee camps in Iraq. And for the last 2 years, we've been building water purification systems in Gaza in schools. And so far, we've built close to 40 water systems. And it's very expensive to do, and we could not have done this work without the support of our community, many of you in the audience, and many more of you tonight, later. And the children in Gaza have had to drink putrid water for many, many years, the water has been siphoned off by Israel. It has been taken into Jewish settlements in the West Bank to fill swimming pools. And because of that, the water table has been lowered to such an extent that it's almost undrinkable. So we have hundreds of more schools to build these in, and I know you're going to help us with that. And that's enough of my going on. I'm very lucky tonight because a very good friend of mine, when asked to come tonight, said, "Of course I'll come." And that good friend is a person who is one of the first people to give a donation to the Middle East Children's Alliance when I founded this organization, Howard and I founded this organization 23 years ago. She was one of the very first people to step forward and say, "I want to support this work. This is really important." She's a woman who we all know. Her writings are magnificent. Her play. There's nothing about Alice that I could say except to say that she's a woman who steps forward, takes chances, got on a boat, on a flotilla to go to Palestine, and has always stood up on the side of justice for children. Please welcome Alice Walker.
Barbara just said to me, "I love you, Alice." And I said to her, "I love you more." And I think that that is how I felt going to Gaza, trying to get there this last time on the flotilla. That I love me very much, but I think I must love the children there more. And I wanted very much to see them and to let them know that there are people in the world who care about them. I think one of the hardest things for all of us is to feel that we're suffering and nobody cares and nobody knows and nobody sees. And this is something that we can change. And that is one of the reasons I really love Mecca. I really, really love them. I think that all these years it has been so difficult for them to be maligned, to be harassed. But they have kept going because they love themselves. You know, when you love yourself, it's easy to be an activist because you know how precious everything is, because you're precious. But you also love the world more. You love the children of the world more. You love the mothers. You love the grandmothers. So, you know, how could I not be here? How could I not say yes as long as I have strength? Who are we not to move forward if we have the energy to do so? When so much has been given to us and so much has been wasted. Look at this poor country of ours. It has wasted so much. It has wasted almost everything. You could start with the topsoil and go on to the air. So here we are in this room, and we know we're small. But we also know that we are occupying Wall Street. We also know that we're small and we're moving. We're moving. It may be too late to move very far, but that's okay. You know, one of the stories I wanted to tell actually was that when we were on the boat, we were trying to leave Athens, Greece, and the Israelis were making it really difficult. And in fact, they sabotaged boats They frightened the poor Greeks so that they weren't supposed to let us even leave the dock, you know, on the coast of Athens. And so we were there in Athens for almost 2 weeks, and it was hot. It was so hot. I don't like so much heat. I'm from the south, and I had enough of it. But anyway, we finally, toward the end of this long wait and all of these horrifying stories, you know, about the Mavi Marmara, we saw a film about the murders that happened on that boat. We did nonviolence training where we faced the reality of being up against people who are brutal and who don't care. And if you're singing, they hit you. And if you try to lock arms, they break your arms. And if you go limp and you lie on the ground, they step on your face. But finally, after waiting for such a long time, all of us decided, but we didn't tell the media, in fact, which was quite funny, except for the media that went with us. For instance, some people from Democracy Now!, a program that I so respect. But anyway, finally we decided that we might not get even into international waters, but we were going to leave the shore. And we did, and we got about 10 miles beyond the Greek coast before we were turned back by people who were armed. But they were armed in ignorance. They had no idea why they were trying to harm us or why they were trying to turn us back. This is one of the delusions that we're caught in, you know, of just not knowing what we're doing to each other. So one of the wonderful things that Medea Benjamin of Code Pink did was she said to them, and actually I didn't see this because I had gone downstairs to be with the circle of meditators who would actually meet the people coming on the boat. But she said to them, you know, look at you, you're holding your guns on us. But imagine if you were not holding those guns, you could use your arms for something else. And then she said to all of the people who, all of our people, turn to the person next to you and hug them. So that is what the people with the guns and their little, you know, I've never seen the ninja people things, but they kept saying that they look like ninjas. So I guess they look like ninjas and with guns. So that's what they had to deal with as they were standing on their little boat, being told to harm us, that we were in fact setting out to humiliate the Israeli soldiers by throwing sulfuric acid on them. They were confronted instead by these smiling Americans, for the most part. There were some other people from other places, embracing each other. And this was part of what it meant to leave the shore. This is part of what it means to leave behind, leave it, all the things that didn't work. And we're there. We are about to leave behind, if we can keep our courage going, all the things that did not work, and most of them did not. And this means that this is a very good time, even if we only get 10 miles into the future. We may get 10 miles and be turned back by who knows what. You know, Nostradamus says that in this period we'll see nuclear war that will destroy the West. So we may not get far, but let us leave the shore. Let us leave. Let us say, oh, you know, they put up every possible obstacle. They sabotage our boats. You know, we have this horrible record of disaster, rain not only on the children of Palestine, but on the people who try to bring aid and assistance to people who need us in Palestine. But we are going to go, we're going to leave the shore. Another story I wanted to say briefly has to do with a young woman whose name is Lisa. And I can't remember what Lisa's last name is. I've been trying today. But she was the person who taught us our nonviolence training. And she was excellent. She was fabulous. And she, at some point I said to her, well, Lisa, you know, actually I want you to go and take a nap because you look like you need one. She was so devoted to getting us in shape to confront whatever we had to confront. But at some point, she realized, as we all did, that we would not be able to deliver the letters. We had this cargo of letters that we were trying to deliver. We would not be able to deliver these letters. So we went to lunch one day at a restaurant, and I saw her just furiously collecting wine bottles. And, you know, just with complete intent, she was collecting these bottles. And she just kept collecting all kinds of bottles and trying them out and everything, because her dedication was that we are going to send these letters if we have to put them in bottles and send them, throw them over the side of the boat. And essentially, that is what she and some of the other women did. They actually, I don't think, used wine bottles, because it turned out that there was something wrong with wine bottles. I don't know what it was, but they used another kind of bottle. I don't want to say the P word, but I think it might have been plastic. But in any case, they put some of the letters into these bottles along with some sand, and they, with prayers and tears, there's a video of this. I find it really difficult to look at it. It's so incredibly moving. Because it's to see the people of the world trying so hard to bring healing to the world, trying, you know, every way. I mean, I don't think Lisa could have done more than she did on the boat, making the bottles with the letters. But you see the people trying so hard to change the world, to change the situation. And then to see how you know, how horribly they're treated, how they're lied about. I mean, I think it was Ali who it, on the Electronic Intifada, which he co-founded, actually ran a photograph that the Israeli Defense Fund, no, Defense Forces, had distributed to show, you know, the wicked people that we were. And there I was, beaming out there, wickedly. you know, that we were going to humiliate the soldiers when they aborted. And meanwhile, we had been spending all of our time trying to figure out how we could not harm them, that they were, in fact, coming to harm us. But how could we not harm them? And the key to this little puzzle of non-harming and harming has to do with who you harm when you harm the so-called other. And this was a teaching that was very much in action on our boat, that there is a part of you, maybe all of you, but definitely a part of you, that must not be harmed by your own need to harm someone, even if they are harming you. It's very tricky. So tonight is a special night for me, to come here, to have gone on that journey, to feel that it's a success. I'm rarely discouraged. You know, I think it's my the ancestry that I have, both Native American and African, and even the poor white part. You know, the Scots, the English, and the Irish. I mean, there's a pluckiness. There's a feeling that, you know, we have seen, you know, we've seen famine, we've seen slave raids, we've seen, you know, rape and pillage and all of that, houses burned, not just in Africa, but in Scotland, you know. I mean, the whole mixture of who we are. I come with all of that, And I bring all of that to this issue of Palestine and Israel. And Ali Abanima was one of the first people to really make it all have a kind of shape for me. That if we could hold to what we know is justice, what is right, we could actually work on this and bring it to a fruition that would make us, you know, if not proud exactly, at least we could sleep a lot better. And part of it is the idea of one country for all the people who live there. And also, very, very key to that, and Ali and I were just talking about this a moment ago, the right of return. Now, if someone is chasing you out of your house, that's a terrible thing. But how much more terrible that you're not ever supposed to come back? I mean, whose idea was that as something that is okay? I mean, it's beyond belief how all of this rottenness, criminality, venality, avarice, just old-fashioned greed and, you know, meanness. This is all so mean that you would deprive people. You would just stand there and watch them forced out of their houses. And you, sometimes, if you didn't tear the house down, you move right into it. In fact, I just wrote a poem about that, about, you know, everybody in this room, one of the hopes of your life should be to hope never to want the home of somebody who has been forced out by your soldiers. Never want it. Never. You will never be happy in it, because it will never be yours. So Ali Abanima is a very beautiful and wise person. And he's someone I have to smile when I think about him, because he's archetypal. And I don't know if he's ever thought about this, but in every community, there is someone like Ali. And in my community, he would have been called right away an old soul. And the old soul, I was thinking today, well, what is the best characteristic of the old soul? And I believe it is that the old soul is the best listener. The old soul, the child in the community, wherever that is the one who listens and hears and has a wonderful memory and is always making connections and always tying the past, the deep past, to the present and to the far future. This is the old soul. And so when such a person is born into a community, usually people know it within days. I mean, this is one of the remarkable things about people like Ali, and I know he's feeling very strange to hear this, but I believe it is true, because in him, his people, and, you know, not just his people, but all the people who, you know, who hunger. I mean, we hunger for justice. We want it like we want bread. You know, to us, it's not just an idea. I mean, we want peace. You know, it's not just because we want them to stop shooting each other. We see that's just incredibly stupid. But we want to be happy. We want to have joy. We want to enjoy each other. So when a person like Ali is born, there is a lot of celebration, because you know they're going to take on, as he has done, so much. You know, that the path is a difficult one. It is a daily challenge. It will sometimes take everything you have and more than you have. And yet, you know, there is just the reality that sometimes such a person is given to us. And we are so grateful. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Alice. I don't know what to say. That was a very moving and humbling introduction. And I'm so grateful to be here with you and with this wonderful community. I'm grateful to be in this space, and thank you to Pastor Jack and his team for welcoming us here today. And I'm very grateful to Mecca for inviting me. This now is the third time, and Mecca is one of the organizations that I feel at peace, because I know Mecca is there and it's doing the work that it does. And but I know what a struggle that is, and how much work Barbara and all of the staff and volunteers at Mecca do, and how much they deserve our support, because they are not engaged in charity work. They're engaged in true solidarity at every level. Now, I'm going to start with a little something. Just a few days ago in Chicago, we had a gathering very similar to this one, also in a beautiful space at the Columbus Park Refectory in Chicago, a beautiful old building. And as we have here tonight, we had many people who are engaged in this struggle, and not just this struggle, but so many other struggles for social justice in this country and around the world, against racism, for housing, for equality, for jobs. And the organization that gathered us that day on Sunday, last Sunday, was the American Friends Service Committee, another organization which I have a great deal of respect and affection for. And we were gathered to celebrate all the work that the people in that room were doing, and we were also there to celebrate Alice Walker, who AFSC had recognized with the Inspiration for Hope Award for the work she does. And since Alice couldn't make it, she did me the tremendous honor of asking me to accept that award on her behalf. And I have brought it with me, Alice, to give to you. And this comes with love from all the people in Chicago. Because Chicago is a city that fights, that struggles, that is in solidarity with people in Palestine, with people in Mexico, with people all over this country, with working people. People are out in the streets in Chicago as they are in San Francisco tonight, and in New York and other places, an awakening of all the people who have been left out, who have been forgotten, who have been silenced, and who are saying, first of all, people are saying, you know, well, Occupy Wall Street, what does that mean? What are the demands? Where does this go? Well, as Alice said, first you have to leave the shore. And I feel that people are starting to leave the shore. And the next thing you have to say is, we exist. When you're forgotten, when you're denied, when you're dehumanized, the first declaration you have to make is that we exist. So if people haven't necessarily formed, manifestos and demands, first of all, they're saying we exist. And that's very important. We exist and we resist. And when you look at what has happened in here in Oakland, I'll say more about this to put this in context, with the art exhibit. And the way Mecca has fought back, first of all, let me give some advice to anyone who wishes us ill. Don't mess with Mecca. They have a print shop. And if you don't like the pictures that the children in Gaza created, because remember that children, all of us as children, all of us, and all of those who have children know this, that before we can articulate our words with speech or in writing, we draw. And if we don't have paper and pens and paint and ink, we will draw pictures in the sand. And so the pictures made by children in Gaza are the most raw and most authentic expression of their experience. And if someone wants to silence that, well, Mecca is going to duplicate those pictures and send them all over the world. And they're going to make badass posters and t-shirts, and they're going to tell everyone about it. So you don't mess with Mecca. Now, I just really think that Alice's metaphor of leaving the shore, of leaving behind what doesn't work, is such a perfect way to think of the moment we're in. Because when it comes to Palestine, it's time to leave behind all the things that haven't worked. And we could go back a long time, but I will just go back to a couple of years, to 2008, beginning of 2009, when the wounds of children in Gaza were still burning from white phosphorus, and President Obama took office. And yet many people had hope that this man would bring some semblance of justice or a change to American policy. And even though he remained silent throughout the bombardment of Gaza and still remains silent about it today, in fact, that's not quite true because he defended it. But nevertheless, people saw some hope in the fact that for the first time in a long time, we heard a U.S. administration demand that Israel stop stealing land and building settlements. And he went to Cairo and talked about how important it was to end the occupation. And yet, without going into all that happened in the past 2 years, look at where we are now. The speech that President Obama gave at the United Nations 2 weeks ago, which was a surrender on top of a surrender to the very worst, most extreme politics. It was a speech which can be summarized really by the endorsement of the Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who said that he would sign on it with both hands. We are in a situation where people say, well, you know, what could the president do? Because the political forces are so arrayed against him. And we've heard that on everything. You know, we have millions of people without jobs in this country. We have especially young people. Youth unemployment is over 25%. And among African-American youth, it's over 40%, approaching 50%. And people say, well, what can he do? Well, you put up a fight. Nobody asked us to come and fight. Many of us would have been there if we were asked to put up a fight. And the same is true when it comes to Palestine. He never put up a fight. And Now we have these claims from the Republicans who, it's so interesting that, you know, for so many decades, U.S. support for Israel was treated as a bipartisan issue. And you didn't see Republicans and Democrats disagreeing about support for Israel. You'd see, you know, John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi standing next to each other, standing behind the Israeli Prime Minister in Congress and agreeing. I mean, I think that, you know, this could have been a really good device to get Congress to do some things. They can't agree on health care reform? Call it Israel care, and then they'll agree. You know, you can't get funding for schools? Change the name of the schools to Israel, and they'll be funded. You know, we have a situation where in the last budget negotiations, they cut, what was it, $514 million for women and infants for nutrition programs. And nobody's talking about, in this country, they're closing down firehouses and police stations and libraries and cutting pay to teachers. We're told that there's, in Congress, people saying the United Nations is getting too much funding from the United States. Well, maybe it is, I don't know. But nobody's talking about the billions of dollars that go to Israel. Well, Israelis have health care. They have public health care. So we have this Congress that insists on subsidizing, what is it, socialist health care for Israelis. It's a Congress of socialists, but only when it comes to Israel. So we can't have a discussion about any of these things because right now the Republicans and Democrats are engaged in a competition to see who can be more fanatically pro-Israel. So it would seem that, you know, just as the young people who are in the streets have concluded that you know, waiting till 2012, and if we can just get the House back into Democratic hands, then everything will be okay. And, you know, if people are tired of that, they're saying we have to go and occupy the streets. And we don't know where this will go, but they're leaving the shore. Well, We already understood that when it came to Palestine. And for the past few years, we have seen a growing global solidarity movement. The support for Palestinian rights has always been strong around the world. Our problem has been how to mobilize it, how to turn it into power, how to turn all that latent support into power that can actually bring change. And I think that over the past few years, we've been seeing a movement growing, particularly among Palestinians, a renewed and redoubled steadfastness among Palestinians in every part of Palestine, whether it's Bedouin in the Naqab in the south being driven off their land, another 30,000 who are now being targeted for expulsion from their land in the Naqab region of southern Palestine, whether it is people in the West Bank seeing their land constantly shrinking as settlers take it, or whether it's people in Gaza living under a brutal siege and blockade. And internationally, we've seen growing support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and it's growing all the time. You remember a few years ago when we were told BDS will never amount to anything. This will never catch on. This will never make a difference. And there's still a long way to go. But I don't think that the Jewish federations would have allocated, as they did earlier this year, $6 million to fight BDS if they didn't think it was going somewhere. I don't think that the local organizations affiliated with this national anti-Palestinian effort would have put so much effort into suppressing pictures drawn by children if they didn't think this movement was going somewhere. Did you see the headline in the foreword? Bay Area Jewish groups celebrate shutting down art exhibit. That was the headline. Who celebrates shutting down an art exhibit? Who celebrates shutting down a children's art exhibit? It shows me that there is a loss of perspective, a loss of humanity, a total absence of introspection among the groups that engage in this kind of intimidation and thuggery. But what happened in Oakland with the Museum of Children's Art is not isolated. And I think it's very important to understand the phase we are in this struggle. And it's one where we're going to see much more thrown at us, at all of us. I mentioned the escalating efforts, the millions of dollars allocated to fighting this movement for human rights in Palestine. Back in February 2010, the Re'ut Institute, an Israeli think tank closely affiliated with the government, issued a report saying that the greatest threat to Israel was not an invading army, not Iranian nuclear weapons. By the way, just yesterday, Haaretz had a piece saying that the former head of the Mossad, Israel's foreign state-sponsored international death squad, the Mossad, said that Iran was many years away from making a nuclear weapon. They really need to coordinate their propaganda messages better with the Prime Minister before he goes to make speeches at the United Nations. But in any case, the Re'ut Institute said that the greatest threat to Israel was what it called delegitimization. That Israel focuses on military threats, but the greatest threat is actually political. It's a threat to the legitimacy of Israel, and that Israel faces the prospect of collapse, like apartheid South Africa or East Germany. The one thing they didn't get is that apartheid South Africa collapsed because apartheid is bad, and people resisted it because it's a bad thing. Not just because there were all these bad people who are, you know, anti-Africana or anti-white, but because there was a struggle for people's rights. But their recommendation was not what my recommendation would have been. Now, if I were making the recommendations, I would say, do justice, and then all of these things you fear will go away. The answer from the Re'ut Institute, and this was what went out to the Israeli government and the pro-Israel groups around the world, was to sabotage and attack the delegitimizers, what they called the delegitimizers, which is all of us. And we were very jealous in Chicago that the Bay Area got named as a delegitimization hub in their report. We work very hard. We work very hard too. And we also want that recognition. Now, interestingly, when we wrote about this report on the Electronic Intifada, we reported on it, and we included also a PowerPoint presentation that had been given by Gidi Greenstein, the head of the Reut Institute, in which he said that Israel's intelligence services should engage in sabotage and attack of the Solidarity Movement. They suddenly realized that, you know, this wasn't such a great thing to publish, so they changed the report. But of course we kept copies, and if you go to the Electronic Intifada, you can see the original words calling for sabotage and attack. And I think that's what happened to you here, that this is what happened with the art exhibit. But it's not just here. We've seen also, just a couple of weeks ago, the Irvine 11, 10 students who were hauled before a criminal court in Orange County and prosecuted for protesting a representative of the Israeli government, a former spokesman of the Israeli army during Israel's 2006 bombardment of Lebanon, who had himself taken part in the 1982 invasion of Lebanon that killed tens of thousands of people. They had briefly protested. It was what they called and what the prosecutors called a Chicago-style protest. You know, you think Chicago-style hot dogs. And I'm very proud that they had been inspired by our Chicago-style reception for Ehud Olmert, the Israeli Prime Minister, who came shamefully to the University of Chicago. They received him and honored him by giving him a platform to give a lecture on leadership. And they paid him tens of thousands of dollars. And they were giving him as an example to the students of leadership. Leave aside, you know, the university doesn't care about the lives of Lebanese and Palestinian children, but the man was on trial at the same time for corruption in Israel. And he was giving the Harris School of Public Policy an annual lecture on leadership. These are the great institutions of our country. In any case, when Olmert came and they banned the media from the auditorium, they banned cameras, they banned, any kind of recording equipment. Well, we took it in anyway. And when we protested, we stood up one at a time and we filmed it and we put it up on the website. And then the following week he came to San Francisco and he got the same reception. I know there are some people in this room who welcomed Ehud Olmert to San Francisco. And that's what inspired the students at Irvine. And Orange County put the top homicide DA on their case. And they wanted these young people to go to prison. And they were convicted. And they were sentenced to 3 years of probation and 56 hours of community service. But they're unbowed. But that was part of the effort to suppress, to delegitimize protest. And there's always been a tradition of protest. When power won't listen, when it doesn't give you a channel to be heard, to change things, you have to stand up. You have to disrupt things. No change came, no important step forward came without somebody disrupting the existing order. And saying, I'm not going to play by the rules that you have set up to preserve your power and your privilege and your situation. In Chicago, just over a year ago, and in Minneapolis and other cities, the FBI came a-calling to many of our friends and colleagues and brothers and sisters, and they started issuing subpoenas, and they raided the homes of a number of activists involved in Palestine solidarity work and labor rights work in this country and abroad. And for more than a year, there has been this witch hunt. They never indicted anyone. They never said there was a danger to anyone. In fact, they said the opposite. There's no danger to the public. What we think they're doing, what we're sure they're doing, is a witch hunt against activists who are engaged in international solidarity work. And there's a lot about those cases on the Stop FBI website and on the Electronic Intifada as well. And the Washington Post did a big piece on this a few months ago that was quite strong. But what they didn't count on, because they subpoenaed more than 24 people, and you know, if you defy a federal grand jury subpoena, you can go to jail. Nobody has gone to jail yet, and I hope nobody will, because I believe they did not count on the huge national community response. The number of people who came into the streets, who responded to the call-in days, and who simply expressed their opposition to this. And I think that's a victory. I think it's because of that public response that they have not dared to put anyone in jail. And I think we have to keep up the pressure. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I don't think it's a coincidence that the United States, and this has been included in speeches both by President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, have pledged the United States to help fight delegitimization. They have adopted the terminology and adopted the word, even, that was given by the Ra'ut Institute and by the Israeli government. So what does it mean for the United States if we know that that the delegitimizers is you here, all of us in this room, and us in Chicago, and the folks everywhere else in this country who are fighting for justice? What does it mean for the government of the United States to fight delegitimization? It means that they're going to fight us. And they have a history of that. Everybody knows what government has been doing to people's movements in this country, from the labor rights movement in the early part of the 20th century through the civil rights movement to this present day. So we have to see these things as connected, but also to understand our strength, that our response does matter. That when they did these things immediately in the wake of 9/11, and they came after people who were identified as scary Muslims and had beards, but what they were actually doing was raising money for schools and clinics and communities in Palestine. But they shut down those charities, and they put those people in jail, and they said they were terrorists. Nobody, very few people, dared to raise a peep, because there was so much fear and intimidation. And they thought they could keep getting away with this. And so they came after they were done with the Muslims. They came after the labor movement and the left-wing groups and whoever else it is. And they thought the response would also be silent. But people are leaving the shore of fear, and they're starting to come back together and to say, enough. And I think that really made a huge difference. You look at what's been happening at the universities and the campuses. Less than 2 weeks, will be the first National Students for Justice in Palestine conference at Columbia University. Is there anyone from here going? Yeah, I can see some hands going up. And this is incredibly important because students time and again prove to be the conscience of a society. The ones who demand that issues that no one wants to talk about be put on the agenda. And so students are bringing forward divestment initiatives on their campuses, and not just about Palestine, but the whole range of U.S. militarism empire around the world, the role of arms companies, and the close connections between universities and the military establishment is being put in the spotlight by students. And we see also the anti-Palestinian groups moving against the college campuses. And we see a very disturbing trend taking shape that it's very, I think, important to understand. Just in the past few days, it was revealed that the United States Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights is launching an investigation at Columbia University, coincidence of coincidences, based on an alleged claim that a student's civil rights had been violated because she was steered away from a course given by Professor Joseph Mesad. This has nothing to do with Professor Joseph Mesad, and the university issued a strong statement saying that. But what it does have to do with is that those bringing the civil rights complaint are members of a national pro-Israel group, Scholars for Peace in the Middle East. And what the key person is himself a former head of the Office of Civil Rights, who now works for a pro-Israel organization. And what we've seen is a pattern of using Title VI civil rights legislation, which was designed to turn back and protect students from the institutionalized racism that existed in the pre-civil rights period, to use that legislation to silence discussion of Israeli apartheid. In other words, to use civil rights legislation to protect racism and apartheid. And the first case, the first investigation by the OCR, the Office of Civil Rights, started here in California at UC Santa Cruz in March. And the Chronicle of Higher Education reported that the investigation was opened because of speech critical of Israel on campus. And the legal theory that's being used is that since criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, then criticism of Israel on campus is a violation of the civil rights of Jewish students. I mean, I think that's an anti-Semitic argument because it automatically assumes that all Jewish people identify with Israel and identify with Israel's racist ideology, and we know that that's not the case. But from UC Santa Cruz, we discovered in August, we published a story in the Electronic Intifada, Stand With Us, another national pro-Israel group, was preparing a similar civil rights complaint against Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Evergreen State was the college attended by Rachel Corrie. And the students at Evergreen State had passed a resolution last year calling on Evergreen State to divest from Israel. To divest from particular companies, not just generally from Israel, but they had identified the companies, including Caterpillar, that made the bulldozer, that the Israeli army used to murder Rachel Corrie. The students at her college wanted their college's money out of Caterpillar. What was so interesting about what we discovered from documents that were not supposed to be published, but Stand With Us had accidentally published online. They were engaged, they're preparing this civil rights complaint against Evergreen State, and they were planning a lawsuit, which they've now filed. We believe they filed it because we revealed their plan to do so, against the Olympia Food Co-op, which also took a historic decision to respond to the Palestinian call for boycott and to deshelve Israeli goods. Two things are interesting about this. First of all of these things were discussed in person between Stand With Us and a representative of the Israeli government, the Consul General in San Francisco, Akiva Tor, who actually went up to Olympia to meet with the plaintiffs who were going to file the lawsuit, who did eventually file the lawsuit against Olympia, and to discuss the civil rights complaint against Evergreen State. You might wonder how it is that the representative of a foreign government is getting involved in these issues, but we believe this is not a coincidence. I think that this is part of a pattern and a policy. And I don't have any evidence of this, but I would not be surprised if the effort to censor the children's art involved the same kind of coordination. That's something worth asking, at least. So I'm telling you all of this because we're going to face more of this. And it is coming at us more and more. But the second important and interesting thing about all of these things is what they don't deal with. Have you noticed? The effort to suppress the Olympia Food Co-op boycott, the lawsuit, is procedural. They're not arguing about Israeli policies or whether boycott is right or wrong. They're claiming that the board did not follow the proper procedures. With the Irvine 11, they didn't want to talk about the rights and wrongs of a representative. I mean, they're talking about the free speech rights of Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador. He wasn't there to give his personal opinion. He was there to represent a state and a government engaged in crimes. It's not as if the Israeli government doesn't have enough opportunities to make its views heard in the United States. They didn't want to talk about that. So they prosecuted the students under an obscure law about disrupting public meetings. The civil rights complaints, the same pattern. They tried to change the focus away from what the students and faculty who are being targeted want to talk about, which is what's happening in Palestine and the U.S. role, to saying that your actions are making students on this campus feel uncomfortable. And all of this is about changing the subject. And what it tells us is that they understand something very important, that they have lost the argument. And we are winning the argument, because the arguments for Palestinian rights are the arguments for the rights and dignity of all human beings. They're arguments that say that in the 21st century, you cannot have a situation where a grandmother born in Palestine is not allowed to return to her home, to her village, just because she's not a Jew. Whereas somebody from San Francisco or Canada or Argentina who's never set foot in Palestine is allowed to go and settle there and take people's land and receive all kinds of state funding simply because of some arbitrary designation. Would we accept that if it was about skin color? Would we say, oh, well, you know, this is very reasonable. We have to understand their fears. So in the 21st century, these arguments don't stand and they can't be won. Although, by the way, in this country, there's plenty of people who would like to turn back the clock. And so that's very important to understand, is that we are winning the argument, and we are facing increasingly these kinds of bullying and intimidation measures that I think, if we're aware of them, if we're smart, if we're united, we'll defeat. They won't stop us. It's not as if they're going to stop us or intimidate us or prevent us from continuing to fight for what we believe in. And they look. You look at some of the other efforts to change the subject, which I think have failed totally. The public relations strategies about greenwashing and pinkwashing or gaywashing, as it's sometimes called, that say, well, oh, you know, Israel's a wonderful place. Look how many trees they plant. Don't look at how many trees they uproot. And, you know, you should support Israel because, you know, they have a gay pride parade in Tel Aviv and they don't have a gay pride parade in Gaza. I don't think these arguments will work because, and then, you know, Israel has all this wonderful medical science. Well, let's suppose that tomorrow Israeli scientists funded by the Israeli government develop a cure for cancer. And that would be a wonderful thing. And there's no doubt that humanity would benefit. But what would be the answer to that? To say, okay, well, since you cured cancer, you can carry on treating Palestinians like, you know, they're not humans. You can carry on taking their land. Why don't you build that apartheid wall a little higher? I don't think that's what the reaction would be. It would be, how can a community that has produced this marvel carry on in this atrocious way? And you must hasten to end it even faster. So that doesn't buy them anything. I don't think the pinkwashing arguments work because they depend on silencing queer people and ventriloquizing them. And what we've heard instead is tremendous resistance saying, no, the state of Israel doesn't speak for us and it doesn't define the boundaries of our solidarity. So looking looking forward, in his speech to AIPAC in May, President Obama said the following. And it's so interesting because there's a kind of bluntness to this. Here are the facts we must all confront. First, the number of Palestinians living west of the Jordan River is growing rapidly and fundamentally, reshaping the demographic realities of both Israel and the Palestinian territories. This will make it harder and harder without a peace deal to maintain Israel as both a Jewish state and a democratic state. That was the president. Now, of course, he's right about the fact that time is running out, not for Israel as a Jewish state or a democratic state, because I would argue that it's neither. It is a sectarian state, an apartheid state. It's never been a democracy, because the democracy was always predicated on the removal, first of all, and the exclusion of those who are not to be included in citizenship. It's like saying the United States has been a democracy for, you know, what do they teach kids in grade school? The United States has been a democracy for 200 years. Oh, really? So it was a democracy when people had slaves. It was a democracy when black people couldn't vote. It was a democracy when women couldn't vote. It was a democracy when only property owners could vote. Well, by that standard, Saudi Arabia is already a democracy. I mean, at best, the United States has been a democracy since 1965. And it's a fledgling democracy which is not getting very high off the ground and has a lot to learn and seems to be going backwards in many respects. But so, yeah, if you apply those standards, Israel is a democracy. But despite all of that, Obama is pointing out a simple reality that Palestinians, if they are not already, will soon be the majority population in historic Palestine, as they were prior to 1948. Of course, he does not call for the morally correct solution, decolonization of the relationship between these populations, equal rights for all who live within the territory, and all who have been unjustly excluded, and restitution and recompense for those who have suffered and lost during this period. Instead, the president exhorts Israel to rush to create a little Palestinian statelet in the false belief that a Palestinian state on a fraction of historic Palestine can fulfill the rights of 11 million Palestinians, or at least sabotage their claim to any greater rights. His use of demographic scaremongering, which you sometimes hear in the United States, of course, about the threat to the United States from the rapidly growing Latino population, the threat, in the words of those who view it that way. But his use of that kind of demographic scaremongering indicates an acceptance of what I see as a fundamentally racist view that the mere existence of certain categories of humans, in the case of Israel, non-Jewish Palestinians, is unacceptable and dangerous, and they have to be limited and contained in a state which is tightly circumscribed. The alternative, as we move away from the shore and leave behind everything that hasn't worked, I think is what is set out clearly in the 2005 Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And some of you know this well, and some of you will be hearing it for the first time. In 2005, almost 200 Palestinian civil society organizations, this is endorsed across Palestinian civil society, inside and outside, called for Israel to be isolated the way apartheid South Africa was. Until Israel respects the Palestinian people's inalienable right to self-determination and upholds international law in three specific ways. All of them have to be met because human rights are not divisible. We can't have only some of our rights. As humans, we deserve all our rights. First, ending the occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling the West Bank Wall. Second, recognizing the fundamental rights of Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality. And third, respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in UN.
back. He left the stage, but he is definitely coming back here to answer your questions. There are a few people that I still want to thank, and one of them is Francine Kuiper, who has always been there for us and did such a great job tonight. And I want to thank IJAN, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, for helping us tonight. And I want to thank KPFA, and in particular Dennis Bernstein, who from his sickbed, he's very ill, and from his sickbed interviewed Aliyah Bunima, I believe it was yesterday or today. And I know that we all wish Dennis the best. And I want to tell you that Mecca is doing a wonderful, is going to have a wonderful event with Aswat at the Islamic Cultural Center here in Oakland on November 20th. And please go to our website and get more information about this event. And stick around because Allie and Alice will be up here signing books at the end of this evening. You know, I was listening to you, Allie, and so many things came to my mind. I was thinking about many years ago when Benjamin Netanyahu thought, in fact, that he could come to the Berklee Community Theater and give a talk, and probably would have had Penny Rosenwasser and I not been told about it 24 hours before and arranged to have a couple hundred people out there shouting and screaming. And in fact, Mr. Netanyahu at the end of the evening decided he would not give a talk at the Berklee Community Theater. And I thought a lot about, you know, before Allie spoke, and for the last few days, and maybe weeks, I've been feeling really a little down. You know, it just sometimes it just gets to you, people saying horrible things about you, about your organization, about and being attacked over and over again. And there are times when I think, oh, the hell with them. You know, I don't give a whatever. But, you know, there's a piece of me that sometimes does care. And recently, I guess I think I cared a little bit. And so I, Allie, you sort of lifted my spirits a little, not just because I heard about all the other people who are under the gun, but I don't know, it was just kind of helpful to me to hear it. I have, you know, this last go-round, there's been so many go-rounds for me and for Mecca, with Netanyahu, you know, when Noam Chomsky came to talk in 91, and 17 professors from the University of California signed a letter and spread it out all across the United States saying that Noam Chomsky and Barbara Lubin were terrorists and supported terrorism and threatened all the bookstores in the Bay Area with pickets if they sold tickets to the event. And the bookstores stood up and told them to go to hell and continue to sell the tickets. When we had an art exhibit, another art exhibit in 2005 at the Berklee Art Center, and 14 rabbis went to see Mayor Tom Bates and tried to threaten Bates and demanded that the city stop funding the Berklee Art Center. And they wanted to have the right to see every art exhibit that was going to come to the Berklee Art Center before it was hung so that they could give a thumbs up or thumbs down. And the mayor stood up to them. And I think what was so depressing to me about this art exhibit was that Mocha didn't stand up. So many people around the country have stood up to these people and have continued to do the work, to have the exhibits, to give the talks, to teach on campuses, and Mocha didn't. And I want to tell you that that exhibit was done by a group of children, most of whom were in a project that Mecca funds. It's called Let the Children Play and Heal. And it's a project that came about as a result of the brutal attack on Palestine almost 2 years ago. I was there during that time. I was in Egypt, and we sent in an ambulance. We sent in food and 4 tons of medicine and toys and all kinds of things. And then I went into Gaza the very last day of the bombing, and I saw for myself what the children drew. I saw those bodies. I saw those funerals. I saw the people crying. And after that, Dr. Mona Alfara, our project director in Gaza, called us and said, we have to do something for the children. And we started a project called Let the Children Play and Heal. And this was a project that trained 450 mothers and teachers, ordinary women, to go to homes and to help with children who were so traumatized by what happened. We still need to fund this project. And I'm leaving on Tuesday to go to Gaza, and I'm going to that project, and I'm asking you tonight to dig into your pockets, to write a check, to give cash, to do what you can to see to it that this project continues. It's a very expensive project. Thousands and thousands of children in Gaza go to it. I want you to help me. There's people with buckets. Where are those people? Where are those buckets? They should be coming around. But even if they don't come around to you, where are you, folks? You can come to me, and you can give me cash, you can give me a check. And I know lots of people feel, well, we paid all this money to come here. It's nothing compared to the need to continue this project. So I want your help tonight, and I want to thank you for coming. And Ali, I want you to come back up here. And now, oh, just read this. Now I'd like to invite. She's so much nicer than I am. I'm like, Ali and Alice, get up here. And she says, now I'd like to invite Alice and Ali back up here to answer your questions. Be brief. A question has a question mark at the end, not a long statement. Be respectful. And Ziad, who I let down tonight because he said to me, the first thing you say when you get up there, you have to talk about the people in the streets in New York and all over this country. And I let him down. But I want to say, we need to be out there with them, not just watch them, not just thank them. All of us need to get into the streets and fight against this capitalist system that we have that's killing so many of us. So Ziad has a microphone, and he's going to come to you, I believe, and you can ask your questions. Raise your hand so he can find you. This is Oakland. There's lots of questions.
What about those the Jewish kids in this country that were just like the Muslims, and they were allowed to get off? They were protesting somebody. Am I the only one that heard about that?
I don't think I know what you're talking about.
Okay.
What's the question?
Does somebody...
Can you talk about that?
Ali, do you know?
Yeah. I think you're referring to the Irvine 11 and why were they prosecuted and not others. It's not a question of Jewish kids, or nobody else would have been prosecuted like these young people were prosecuted in Orange County. And it's impossible to imagine that any students would have been prosecuted for doing exactly the same thing to, say, President Ahmadinejad of Iran. You remember he spoke at Columbia University a few years ago. Or if students had done the same acts of disruption, but their message had been one of support for Israel, would Orange County have prosecuted them? So really, it's not a question of saying, you know, Jewish kids. I did this in Chicago. I stood up and I disrupted Ehud Olmert. And many of us did. We weren't prosecuted. We didn't know if we would be arrested or not. We were ready to. But, you know, they wouldn't have prosecuted us in Chicago for this. So that's what's so outrageous about this, because I think it is intending to send a message, at least across California, and if not across the country, that protest is being criminalized. And that's, you know, something that's a danger to all of us.
This is for Alice Walker. Alice, my parents left their shore to come to this country in the early 1900s. Today, Palestinian students are not allowed to leave their shores to go to a university in London or New York. What do you think about that?
Well, I think
do you have any idea of what we can do to help them get away from, to get to the school that they want to get to?
Yes, you can help them. You can find out what you need to do to help them and then help them. To me, that's actually very simple. It may not be as simple to you. But I think in every case where you see a need and you can find in yourself a place that responds, go there and work from that place. I was just thinking about how to really make some of the changes that we need to make. And actually, I hope I will get around to writing this poem. But for instance, changing the world is really a lot simpler than we sometimes think. Like if you hire someone who has many, many fewer dollars than you, I won't say a poor person, because sometimes poor people are actually quite wealthy in many ways, but if someone comes to you and they have very few dollars, or no dollars, maybe nothing, then part of your duty is to actually, and they are coming to you for work, part of your duty, I believe, to them and to change in the world is to actually pay them more than they ask you. I also feel that when the same person with no dollars and no pennies comes to you and they have children, that your duty is to ask about the education of their children and to help them fund that education. These are things that have never been done systematically at all, and hardly ever, of course, under enslavement of people and extermination of people. But imagine what it would have been like if the people who basically worked our parents to death had said to them instead, you know what, I'm going to make sure that you are paid more than you think you're worth, because often people with few dollars think they don't have much worth. And I'm going to see to it that your children get as good an education as they possibly can, even given this horrible situation of what segregation or Jim Crow or whatever it might be. So my feeling is that there is a place of personal responsibility in the world, and that looking always to other larger forces can be very debilitating. It can make you feel weaker than you are. Whereas if you just start with the need that you see that appears, needs appear in your kitchen. They appear in your, on your doorstep. You know, every day there's something that comes to you that you can do. And just do it.
I have a question for Ali about what's maybe going on at the UN, because I know you've written a lot about a one-state solution, and what's going on at the UN is about two states. And I have friends that ask for my opinion, as little as it is, and I need help in communicating some support for the Palestinian need to be recognized. At the same time, a demand for two states that I don't feel is viable. So I really like your insight and advice and help with this.
Thank you. Let me see if I can. I think a lot of people felt a sort of emotional satisfaction at seeing Palestine placed at the center of the UN agenda, at the frustration of the United States and Israel in trying to block this initiative. in seeing a standing ovation for the speech that Mahmoud Abbas gave, in which he enumerated for the first time, we're not used to hearing him speak about what actually happens to Palestinians. And I can understand that people felt a lot of satisfaction about that. I think there's a kind of satisfaction in seeing UNESCO voting by a large margin to approve a preliminary, at least a preliminary step for Palestine to join UNESCO. And Hillary Clinton, who I forget whether she is now the Israeli foreign minister or the U.S. Secretary of State, railing against this and saying how, you know, it's such a terrible thing if the Palestinians join the United Nations Educational, Social and Cultural Organization. It really shows a deep hatred for Palestinians, a real vicious hatred that you wouldn't want them to join an educational, social, and cultural organization. A little bit like trying to suppress children's art shows really a virulent hatred for Palestinian children, I think. But I think that the challenge for us is to remain focused beyond these largely symbolic steps on what they do for Palestinian rights. And I think that we must not confuse statehood for rights. Statehood and rights are not the same thing. In fact, there are too many states that have violated their people's rights and do violate their people's rights. And we see also in so much of the what's sometimes called the Third World, there was a great optimism and hope after formal decolonization in the 1950s and 60s that turned to disappointment, because having a state did not change the fundamental colonial relationship between North and South and between the former colonial powers and the former colonized countries. The colonial relationships simply were expressed in different ways. And I think that, you know, a Palestinian state, if it were born tomorrow in whatever shape, would already be, it would be born a failed state. It would be the shortest, instead of going from independence in the 1960s to being a failed state in the 2000s, it would be simultaneously independent and failed at the same time. And it would be failed not just because Israel would retain control over the land, the people, the water, the airspace, but because it would already be organized and ruled like so many other states by a very rich, limited neoliberal elite who are already running the Palestinian Authority in the interests of very few wealthy families and excluding the vast majority of Palestinians from having any say. And I speak for myself, but I want something different. I don't want that. It doesn't interest me. And so I think the debate among Palestinians has been to try to bring this back to what it does for Palestinian rights. And in leaving behind what doesn't work and going to and leaving the shore to something else, one of the challenges is to bring the voices of Palestinians back into this, because the so-called peace process over the past two decades has been about systematically disenfranchising Palestinians, of redefining the Palestinian people to eliminate the diaspora and the refugees, to eliminate Palestinians in Israel, and to reduce the Palestinian people to the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and then eventually to reduce it to the West Bank and to hell with Gaza. Gaza is now excluded as well, and maybe tomorrow the Palestinian people will just be Ramallah, and maybe then just a few neighborhoods of Ramallah, and then maybe a few households in Ramallah, and they will be the ones who speak for and represent the Palestinian people. And that's why I resist the UN initiative. because it also ignores the fact that Palestinian civil society hasn't called broadly for, yes, there was some enthusiasm, a kind of euphoria. A lot of it was sort of orchestrated, but some of it was genuine. It's simply for the reasons I mentioned. But beyond that, Palestinian civil society didn't call for this UN initiative. It did call for BDS. And the BDS call sets out demands that are more than just statehood. They're about the rights of all the Palestinians, those in the West Bank and Gaza, those in what is now called Israel, and the diaspora. And so that's the measure by which I think we need to look at any initiative. Does it include all Palestinians? Does it advance all their rights? And the statehood initiative at the UN, despite the emotional satisfaction of some parts of it, just doesn't do that.
I have a question for Ali, right over here. I'm from Santa Cruz, and I saw what I've been keeping an eye on what's going on at UCSC. Tammy Ross Benjamin, the professor that brought the complaint forward and is getting the university investigated for being, you know, quote, anti-Semitic. And it disgusts me that all this government money and energy and all this is going in, and everything you said about them using something that's supposed to be dealing with civil rights for such just backward cause. But anyway, I'm now attending UC Berkeley, and I've seen some ads in the paper at the campus at UC Santa Cruz, and also similar propaganda going on at UC Berkeley on campus, where groups like Stand With Us are presenting this really simplified version, which isn't surprising because it's easy for people to swallow and most people don't really understand the issue. But what they're presenting is basically that Obama is saying there needs to be negotiations. Netanyahu is saying, we're saying yes to negotiations and yes to peace and yes to this. And then they have Mahmoud Abbas saying no to a Jewish state and no to negotiations and no to... And it's like a completely simplistic, ridiculous thing. But I'm just wondering if you could say, like, if you were to encounter that kind of propaganda on campus and you were a student, like, what would you say to those people who are saying that Mahmoud Abbas is no to a Jewish state, no to negotiations?
Yeah, it's very simple. I use a simple analogy. I probably used it here before, the pizza analogy. And, you know, at the AFSC event the other day, the director of Chicago, AFSC in Chicago, said, you know, your pizza analogy, have you ever tried it in real life? I'm going to say what it is now. I said, no. He said, well, I tried it in real life recently with a group of young people in a classroom. But basically, you know, if you imagine two people or two groups of people negotiating over a pizza, and while they're negotiating, you know, if I'm one of the parties, I start eating the pizza as fast as I can. What more do you need to say? So even if you accept the notion of negotiations and accept the notion of two states, it's patently absurd when, you know, one side is eating the pizza as fast as possible. And that's it. It's simple. And they don't have an answer to that. So, but really, you know, I think we've moved beyond that kind of simple propaganda, and they know it, which is why they're not relying on it. They're relying on these kinds of intimidation tactics that I spoke about earlier. And the reason I chose to focus this evening so much on what's happening in this country is because I really do think this is where the battle is going to be won and lost. And this is why the resources are being put into fighting us back here. And the steadfastness of Palestinians on the ground, of Palestinians in Gaza, the importance of the work that Mecca is doing, is all crucial. But the battle is really going to be won and lost to a large extent here. And it's not just you know, Palestine is in many ways the keystone, but it's about much more than Palestine, because it's about, you know, what kind of country this is going to be. I think a lot of the young people involved in the protests have the right idea, but I saw one sign on the internet I didn't like. I think it was in a protest in Indiana, where there's, you know, people, there's lots of stereotypes about Indiana, but there's lots of working people who are suffering there as everywhere else. But it talked about the United States as a once proud nation. And I didn't like that because, you know, this is a country with a terrible history. You can only be very proud if you exclude all that history. But really about the future, this is a country where, you know, Amanda Knox has helicopters following her back home. You know, they do like the slow, the O.J. Simpson car chase with helicopters for Amanda Knox. And nobody's talking about the continued occupation of Afghanistan, of Iraq, of this expanding U.S. wars in Yemen, in Somalia, you know, the spread of AFRICOM and U.S. militarism into Africa, just a country that executes people, whether by drone in foreign countries or by poisoning them while they're strapped to a gurney in this country. I think when the president talks about shared values with Israel, you know, we really have to think about what that means. So I went broader than your initial question, but the battles on the campuses are really part of a much bigger political struggle that I think we have to see ourselves engaged in.
I'd like to ask you about some of the battles in regards to BDS, because I'm with Ecumenical Peace Institute, and we're aware of the battles within the churches. The Presbyterians and the Methodists, I know, are both struggling with trying to get BDS adopted by national bodies and so forth, even by local and statewide bodies. And that's why our dinner is going to be focusing on that subject, by the way. But anyway, can you speak about the battles for BDS in the various and sundry battlegrounds?
Yes, and I just want to take this opportunity to say that there's a petition going around, and Jane, who is wearing the fantastic flag dress, if you are a California resident, be sure to sign the petition for the California Divestment Initiative to get Palestinian California state pension funds out of companies that support Israeli human rights abuses. The battle about BDS is it's so interesting. Good question. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And a good way to find out more is to go to the website bdsmovement.net. And it's got all the basics. And I think that's important to know. But BDS isn't just about victories and defeats. It's not just about did you win this campaign or did you not win. It's about educating people along the way. And that's a very crucial part of BDS, that it's still a long road. And there have been more victories in terms of getting investments withdrawn or contracts cancelled in Europe. South Africa, the University of Johannesburg took a historic decision to break ties with Ben-Gurion University in Israel because of its close support for Israeli government policies and occupation militarism. So there are victories around. There are so many in Europe. That it's really, we're at a stage where it's still gaining momentum in the United States. We're still on a much a shallower path. But as I said, I think that the power of the movement is recognized by our opponents, which is why they're investing so much in trying to stop it. But I don't think throwing millions of dollars and slick ad campaigns is going to stop it, because the people in the churches, the people in the unions, the people in the universities and elsewhere who are taking these initiatives forward, in my experience, having met them all over the country, have a dedication and a determination and a calling that only gets strengthened by that kind of opposition. So I have a lot of faith and belief in those people that they're going to that this movement is really going to take off in this country.
Hi there. Thank you for coming. I actually learned quite a bit tonight. I'm not too familiar with all these issues, but I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate your excellent speeches. Excuse me. I actually marched today with the Occupy SF group and immediately came here afterwards from an invite. As you all know, there are thousands of people who are pretty fed up with this capitalist system that was mentioned. I'm curious, are you familiar with some of the post-capitalist, global, cooperative sustainability movements that are going on now? And I wonder if they would, if you weren't, if you'd like to. I could speak on them, I guess, for a moment, but there's so much to say. I'm a member of what's called the Zeitgeist movement. If, I don't know if any of you are familiar, but it's basically moving beyond capitalism and competition into a total global equality, well-being society. So my question is, have you heard of it? And if so, could you speak on things like that? Curious.
Well, I think that all the thinking that we can be doing now, all of us, is good. And sometimes we don't know what the other person is thinking, but that should not prevent us from coming up with our own dream of how we want this world to be. So I think, for instance, that not only is capitalism a fatal disease of people, because you have to just keep buying and selling and cutting trees and destroying rivers in order to make a profit, but that there are so many other ways that people sitting in circles together can come up with. And I say that we should do that. For instance, I have no interest at all in the electoral politics of this country. I just feel that it's a failure. And if every 4 years we get suckered into believing that we can actually change through a corrupt system that has never worked for us. And I think the time has come for us to just let it go and to sit with each other and talk about what would we like. You know, do we really want to be led by one person? I don't. I mean, I can barely lead myself as one person, but I certainly don't want to look around and think that a president, whether it's a man or a woman, can actually lead us. I mean, look at what has happened to Obama. He has been sucked into a machine that has been destroying us all these many hundreds of years by now for some of us. You know. So there is a different way, and there doesn't have to be just one way. I believe very firmly in the council model, which when the quote white founding fathers got here, they actually learned from the Indians that you actually can lead people and lead yourself in council, and you have to be also in council with the women. When the white people came to talk, quote, peace and whatever, while they were stealing land from the Indians said to them, where are your women? That's the crucial question. Where are your women? So whether a structure is, you know, some model that looks great, that people are putting forward, I mean, that's fabulous. But the question has to be for all of us, how are we going to make this thing egalitarian? And how are we going to make the each gender feel that it is our right to lead in this perilous time? Because if we can't have a system, if we can't have a system that really listens to all of us, and where the women are not turned into men, we're doomed. For instance, when we were on the boat, getting to go on the boat. Who should side with Israel against us but Hillary? Now, I know a lot of you in here voted for Hillary, didn't you? Yeah, well, anyway. So she said that basically we were a threat, you know, to Israel, and that Israel had a right to defend itself against us. Okay. If this is what we're going to have by electing women who rapidly become male-oriented, we don't want that. And we don't want a system in which that can happen. So it's on us. It's such a wonderful time. I mean, maybe, you know, they say that, you know, to make a tree, a barren tree, produce fruit, you threaten it with fire. And maybe we're being threatened with fire. Maybe that's what this is. We're being threatened by fire, and we are to produce some fruit. Are we not going to make it? And it's us. It's not them. It's not that. It's not who. It's not when. It's not where. It's all of us. And if it's not all of us, it will fail.
If I may add one thing, because there's one topic we didn't address tonight, which is we talked about what's happening here, and we talked about Palestine and the connections, but Palestine also exists in the broader Arab context, and what's happening there is incredible, because the uprisings in Arab countries have inspired people here. All of the official dogma is that they're supposed to learn from us. We're the leaders. We know democracy. And yet young people in the streets here are being inspired by the uprisings in the Arab world. And what connects them, and maybe some of us realize it and some of us don't, is that it's a struggle really against the same forces, because the counter-revolutionary forces in the Arab world are the same forces that people are starting to rise up against here. We're beginning to see the crumbling of the system that's existed since the end of World War II, of U.S. hegemony in the region, of U.S. imperial power replacing European imperial powers in the Middle East or in West Asia. And we see the United States fighting tooth and nail against Arab uprisings. And none of these revolutions are completed, not in Tunisia and not in Egypt especially, where you see the U.S. Through its relationship with the Israeli military, trying to maintain, if not Mubarak, then Mubarakism. And you see the U.S. fighting to keep regimes in place in Bahrain and in other countries where all of a sudden it has no interest in people's rights. So it really is a global struggle, and the jury is out as to where it will go. But I think that as much as we can do to raise people's consciousness of the direct connections and the methods, you know, the methods that are being used, the more likely we are to succeed, I think.
Okay, so we're just going to take one more question. And when we're finished with the next question, if people will form, you know, two single lines so that you can come up and either get your book that you're buying in the lobby now or brought with you, have it signed, or just want to come up and meet Allie and Alice, that's fine too. So before that last question, I want to thank everybody for coming. And I want to remind you, please sign the Mecca mailing list so you'll know when these events are happening in the future. And what's the last question?
So this is the last question. It's I hope it's a good one, because it better be, because it's the last one, right? But a perfect segue to what Mr. Ali just talked about is sometimes I feel like the hardest question as a half Jordanian Palestinian with roots in the Hejaz, like the hardest question I face is, where are you from? And that is a very serious question, because I think right now with the so-called Arab Spring, the colonially constructed nationalisms are falling. And yet, you see in the last attempt where Mahmoud Abbas was at the UN trying to plea for, to construct a false nationalism for himself and his people. And I see there's this inverse relationship going on. And that makes me wonder as to why. I mean, why is it that there are some in the Palestinian leadership still like going after these false gods, and if that's because they're in the concentrated in power today, then where is the Palestinian people's Tahrir Square, and where are they meant to make these, where are these conversations meant to happen? Where are our streets? And more importantly, when the T-shirt flag was very charming, but at the same time, to me, it poses a very sad reality that we're still thinking in terms of nationalisms. Like, we still want flags. We still want to wave. We still call ourselves us Palestinians with this Palestinian culture and stuff. That's all good and great, but I mean, aren't we still playing the same old game of just independence and nationalism? And aren't we still going around in circle? Even with the Libyan revolution, they're carrying the kingdom flag right now, and to me that's like, why did we go back? Why are we reversing? Why are we nostalgic for a greater past? Why can't this leaving the shore envision something bigger than these like restrictive nationalisms?
Wow, well that was just beautiful. I mean, I think you posed all of the questions that I think are the urgent ones we have to face. I speak only for myself, but I know that I also meet a lot of young Palestinians and others when I travel. And I know that what you said resonates with a lot of people, that the flag and the state doesn't answer people's aspirations anymore. It doesn't meet their needs. And I think especially in a world where people are very connected, where, you know, people do see what's happening everywhere. And I think they do yearn for something that transcends these notions that we exist in little blocks, delineated by lines, you know, an invisible line has just such tremendous power over people. And I'll say something very briefly personal, which is that, you know, I had a very good life growing up. I had every advantage. I had the opportunity to have the best education, and I recognize that was a gift I had that many people didn't have. But the one thing I never had really was a sense of belonging anywhere I lived. Everywhere I lived, I didn't feel like I really belonged there. And so I had to develop, I think, a sense of, the question I always disliked the most is, where are you from? Because it's never a short answer. You know what I mean, right? It's a long discussion, and sometimes you don't feel like having that discussion. But where I'm from is my community, and my community is defined very broadly. And mostly my community is defined by people who are struggling for the same things I believe in wherever they are. And that's the community that I aspire to belong to and aspire to be considered part of.
You know, I think another answer to that question might be that we don't know. And that I, you know, as somebody who has been in many movements my entire life, whether it was fighting the war against the war in Vietnam, whether it was writing laws and fighting for the rights of children with all abilities and disabilities and suing states and schools, up until today, I don't think that we have a real vision of where we really want to go in the world and in this country. And I think maybe, you know, the folks on the street and those that join them might be coming up with some answers for us. And that young people, you know, we haven't done such a great job. I'm 70 years old. And although I've tried to make differences and make a change, you know, we've belonged to different parties and we've struggled for many, many years and we've struggled for flags and nationalism, and now we don't know where we're going. And I think in a way that's very freeing too, because we know what hasn't worked, and now hopefully we're open to a new way of thinking, and it's going to be a journey for everyone. Thank you for coming.
Could I just say one thing? We belong to each other. And we belong to the planet. And in a way, we have to go through these baby steps of nationalism and being a people separate to understand that, to get to that place where you are me and I am you, and this mother that we're on is ours and we are hers. I think that is the vision that I believe most deeply in. Thank you.
So anybody that wants to form lines and come on up, please do it.